Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Jason Wilbur, musician, songwriter, and recording artist. Jason has performed all over the U.S. and Europe, playing a variety of instruments while backing up notable folk, rock, and country musicians such as Carrie Newcomer, Todd Snyder, Hal Ketchum, Kim Fox, Greg Trooper, Tim Grimm, Iris DeMent, and since 1996, Jason's been the lead guitar player for singing-songwriting legend John Prine. Jason lives in Bloomington, Indiana, and has three solo CDs out, including Behind the Midway, King for a Day, and his first CD, which was Lost in My Hometown. Jason, welcome to Profiles.
Thanks, Shauna.
Jason, I've read someplace that you actually started playing piano when you were about 5 years old before you moved on to guitar. What drew you to the piano?
I think my mom and my sister were taking piano lessons, and so I was included in that group.
So you were actually taking lessons?
Yeah, I went to, at the time, I went to a Lutheran school for my, I think, kindergarten and first grade. And so I took lessons from the music teacher at that school. His name was Mr. Mueller. I remember that.
Did you stay with piano for a long time?
I didn't. I think it seemed like I took lessons for about a year. But, you know, at that age, that could have been a month. I don't really remember for sure. It was a while, though, because I remember working through the little book a ways. But then I didn't want to do it anymore. I quit. And I remember the reason I told my mom was that I wanted to play the drums instead.
And did you get a drum set right
No.
away? Pots and pans. What did
no,
you
there
hit?
Was no drum was in the in the works there. So I just stopped and then I didn't really take any music lessons for a while after that.
Did you feel an immediate affinity to music? I mean, did you walk around singing? Was there a lot of music in your home?
Well, there was a lot of music in our home from records. My earliest musical memory is sitting at the little record player that my parents had and either playing my kid records, but Disney-type records, or playing some records from my dad's record collection, which was mostly country and Western music.
Uh-huh. So what was your favorite Disney song?
Well, I really liked they did a cartoon version of Robin Hood, which many years later I found out was Roger Miller doing all the music and narration. And I really liked that a lot. But I didn't, of course, at the time, I didn't know it was Roger Miller, know who he was. But a long time later, I mean, when I was in my 20s, maybe, I remember hearing Roger Miller's voice and going, oh, wow, that's the guy from the Robin Hood movie.
So there was a country influence even way back with the Disney records.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. How about that?
And when did you start playing guitar and when did you start playing seriously and how'd that happen?
I started playing seriously probably around the fifth grade, maybe, on guitar. My dad had a really inexpensive guitar that I think my mom got him for his birthday, but it was from a record store. It wasn't really what we'd call a real instrument. It was really difficult to play. And so I kind of wrestled around with that as a kid, but it was hard to make any progress because the instrument was so poorly made that it was difficult to really get anything out of it, you know? So I remember thinking how difficult it was to play the guitar. But then at some point around, I'd say, the fifth grade, one of my uncles, my uncle Jim, my dad's brother, had a couple guitars and was taking lessons. And I went to his house, and his guitars were really easy to play.
Uh-huh.
You know, because you could push the strings down. They weren't really far off the neck and everything. And then so I started, that was kind of encouraging, and he showed me some chords and gave me some sheets with words and for songs that I knew and the chords on them. So that's when I started kind of getting a little bit excited and making some progress with it, you know.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is singer, songwriter, and recording artist, Jason Wilbur. Jason, did you have an immediate feeling of like, oh, at homeness once you hit a guitar that you could actually play around on? Were you the kind of kid who, like, did you love school? Did you love math and English and music was just one more thing that you added to it? Or was it like, oh, music?
I'd say it was more like, oh, music, unfortunately. When I was in elementary school, I remember doing okay in most subjects. But as I got older and got into middle school and high school, it was definitely music. I really was not interested in anything else.
And you moved to Bloomington right around that time from Fort Wayne, right?
Yeah, right after my freshman year of high school.
What was that change like for you? Because I know Fort Wayne's quite a bit different than life in Bloomington.
Well, initially it was pretty unpleasant, you know. That's not a very good time to move. But once I made some friends and got to know other people involved in music down here, it turned out to be a great place to live, of course, because there was so much music, you know, because of the university, and there was just a great music scene at that time.
So were you actually taking lessons on guitar and other instruments like banjo and mandolin, or were you just playing around on your own?
Well, when I was still up in Fort Wayne and a sixth grade through ninth grade, I took music classes in school. So those were the only lessons I was taking then. And then I was just sort of dabbling around on my own. And then when I moved down here, I can't remember exactly when, but sometime not too long after I moved down here, I started taking lessons, guitar lessons from... Initially, I think the first guy I took was from a guy named Kenny Strong, mm-hmm. who's a really nice guy and was helped me out a lot. It was very encouraging and helped me get jobs with bands and things when I was still pretty young. And then I took lessons from a guy named Chris Hadding for a while. And then I took, you know, and there are a few other people that I may have taken one or two lessons from, you know. But those
and did you hole up in your room and practice for hours and
I
hours?
I did, yeah. Yeah, I am. You know, I just was interested in it. It didn't seem like a lot of work, but yeah, I definitely would. All throughout my teen years, I had a rule. I tried never to go a day without playing at least a little, even if it was only a few minutes. And for the most part, I probably played quite a bit more than that every day, you know.
So when did you, was there a moment when you said, aha, this is what I want to do forever? Or was it just more of a gradual slide in?
I guess it was sort of a gradual slide. I don't know if I really had an idea of doing any. You know, at the age when I was 13, 14, I don't know how far into the future I was thinking. I mean, I've definitely fantasized about, you know, being a professional musician and traveling around and riding on a tour bus and playing big shows. And I would read about it in magazines, you know. So it was definitely a fantasy. I guess there was a point in my mid-teens when I was working in bands every weekend and making, you know, $50 a night or whatever we were making. And I remember thinking, well, gosh, I could just do this. You know, I mean, if I'm making this much now as a 15-year-old or 16-year-old, you know, I could do this. I mean, this is pretty good. So.
Now, you were playing in bands, if I remember correctly, with folks who were quite a bit older than yourself
most of the time. Pretty much most of the time. The bands that worked, anyway. I was in a few bands with guys my own age, but we never had any gigs.
What kind of music were you playing?
Pretty much country, country western, some rock. There was the bands during that time, it's probably the same now, that play like all the fraternal clubs and things like that around town, and you would play a mixture of kind of classic country mixed in with 50s and 60s rock and a few newer things.
So mostly covers?
Oh, totally. Exclusively covers, yeah, during that time.
When was it that you wrote your very first song?
I'm not sure I remember. As a kid, I always wrote things. You know, whether they were songs or poems or not so much stories. I like the idea of writing stories, but I never had the follow through or whatever to get very far, you know. So I was writing, but I really can't remember. It doesn't stick out. I wrote all kinds of little songs and things all throughout my childhood, as far as I can remember. I remember the first things I wrote were generally the melody. I would use a different melody and kind of write my own words to it. You know, mm-hmm. the melody of an existing piece and make up my own words. And sometimes I wouldn't even write them down, you know.
Just hum them.
Yeah, I would walk around the yard singing them to myself, or, you know.
And was your family really encouraging with you with music, or?
They really were. Yeah, I would have to say they were really encouraging.
Well, what I'd like you to do now, if you're willing, is to play one of your own songs. Which one would you play for us?
I guess I'll start with a song called Lazy Afternoon.
And is this a new song, or?
This is a pretty new song. I wrote it a year or two ago, which is new for me. And I wrote it kind of inspired by my love of Impressionist painters. And I wrote it after I was up in Chicago doing a show with Iris Dement. And we were staying near the Art Institute, and so I always like to go over there and see. They have such a great collection, you know, of paintings. And while I was there, I got a little book about the Impressionists. And one of the things I read in there was that that the author thought that one of the reasons these paintings were so enduring and that people still love them is because they usually kind of depicted scenes of outdoor leisure. You know, of people sitting by the river, swimming, or walking in the country, or that kind of gave me an idea of if I wondered if I could do that in a song, and so this is the result.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and we're listening to Jason Wilbur playing "Lazy Afternoon," a song that he wrote.
I love to watch the wind in the locust trees, and the way the sun feels so warm on me and on you too, and everyone who has come to sit out in this lazy afternoon. You swear smell those flowers bloom. I believe you can. I smell them too in the grass.
Lazy Afternoon by Jason Wilbur. Jason, your song Lazy Afternoon can also be found on your website, Jason Wilbur, and that's Wilbur with an E-R, right? JasonWilbur.com has information about you and also some of your songs that you can find on air. So if you're interested in hearing that, you could go to JasonWilbur.com. So, Jason, tell me a little bit more about your songwriting process. You said when you wrote Lazy Afternoon, you were inspired by looking at Impressionist paintings, and you sort of wanted to grab the mood of that.
Yeah, that was the general idea I was working with, right?
So do you start with a tune, or do you start with words, or does
Yeah, that's
that vary?
A good question. That song, I started out with thinking about not making one of these things that I consider a mistake in writing, which would be if I was going to try to write something inspired by Impressionist paintings, for me to try to write something about the French countryside, you know, which I know nothing about. And so I tried to think of what would be something from my life that had that kind of mood, you know, that sort of leisure kind of thing. I don't know about the words or melody. I find that words, when you speak naturally, your words tend to have a rhythm and a melody to them. And so I think that's a lot of times where my melodies come from. Because I think the lyrics are probably my strength and the melody is a little more difficult for me. So I often start with the natural rhythm and mood of the words I'm thinking of and try to grow something out of that.
Okay. You recorded your first solo CD in 98,
right,
which was Lost in My Hometown, and followed it up in 2000, if I remember correctly, with Behind the Midway.
Yes.
And there's quite a shift in some ways between the two of those CDs. Mm-hmm. Lost in My Hometown is very for me, at least as a non-musician, is very folky sounding.
Interesting.
And I love the lyrics to the song Lost in My Hometown, by the way. I think
thanks.
They're really wonderful. And then Behind the Midway has a little bit more of a punch to it. Did something happen in those 2 years that sort of shifted your style, or was it just two different pieces?
Yeah, I'd say it was more two different pieces, because probably the songs overlapped a lot in terms of when I wrote them and things like that. Might have been a little more a function of the recording process and the musicians that I was working with. Let's see, Lost in Your Hometown was a little more of I really had the idea of just kind of recording some of my songs, not so much to make a CD. But after we'd recorded a bunch of things, I realized I could kind of put them all together and make a CD out of it. Whereas with Behind the Midway, I definitely went in and had an agenda, you know, and was had this group of songs and wanted to record it as quickly as possible.
As quickly as possible. You mentioned that being around different musicians and having different musicians in really influences your music. You've played with lots of different folks. You mentioned mm-hmm. Iris DeMent, Carrie Newcomer. Mm-hmm. Of course, you've been touring with John Prine for the last 6 or 7 years, right?
9 years. Yeah.
9 years. Wow. Yeah. How have they influenced your music?
It's similar to the way that all, you know, the music you hear from anybody else does. I mean, I think as a, I mean, you're a writer, and I think it's probably similar. You know, you kind of absorb what you like, I think, from other people's work. When you see something that's exciting, you go, ooh, I like that. You know, I got to figure out a way to bring that into my thing, you know, into my style or my work. So I think I've been influenced that way. I think the privilege of working closely with someone as opposed to just hearing their music strictly as a listener or as a, you know, from recordings and things. When you work with someone personally, you get a little more of an idea of maybe their process of working as opposed to just hearing the finished product, you know. So that's always influential.
You've been touring for 9 years now with John Prine.
Right.
And I know you mentioned that when you were a teenager, you sort of had fantasies about the tour bus. So
right.
Does the reality match up to the fantasy?
It does in some ways. It does in some ways. It's funny. The thing I never thought about as at that age is, you know, when you're out traveling and playing music, how little of your day is spent playing music and how much of it is spent checking in and out of hotels and waiting for something to happen, you know, or sitting on a plane or a bus or in a car. It has, though. It's great. I feel really lucky to have gotten to do the things I've done. And it's a lot of fun to travel around and play, although sometimes the traveling part is less fun.
Hard to be away from family sometimes.
It's hard to be away from the family. And it's just, you know, it's really neat to see new places. I love to travel, but the kind of traveling you do as a performer is usually you're somewhere for a day, you know, and most of the day is spent up doing all kinds of things, and then a couple hours of it is playing some music, and so it's not really like vacation travel, you know. it's a little different, so I'd say that gets a little tiresome at times, but it's still a lot of fun. I mean,
How do audiences vary both across the U.S. mm-hmm. and in Europe? Is there a different tenor to concerts,
oh,
a different way
yeah.
that you receive? Talk about that
totally.
A little bit.
Well, let's see. Some places, maybe more rural places, a lot of times the audiences are a little rowdier and uninhibited, I'd say.
what happens, Jason?
Oh, no, I don't mean it that. I just mean that they'll tend to shout more and, you know, yell during a song maybe or clap and hoot and holler. Whereas when you get into cities, they get a little more sophisticated and they don't quite behave that way. You know, they may be a little quieter and not as much screaming and hollering. I also noticed there's a strong correlation with whether or not there's alcohol being served at the venue, too. People tend to, of course, yell and scream and a lot more when there's drinking involved. Then when you go over to Europe, it's different. Like in England, the crowds are totally silent while you're performing. And then when you're done, they clap.
And so is that unnerving a little
it's
bit?
It's a little unnerving, yeah, because a lot of times in the U.S. or other places, if you say something, a certain line of a song, people will respond in some way. They'll yell or laugh or clap a little bit. But a lot of times there, it's total silence, and then they clap at the end, which is great because it's very respectful. I mean, they're really listening to everything. But if you're not used to it, it's a little odd because you might think, gee, maybe they don't like this very much, you know, and then at the end they clap. Scotland is a little more hooting and hollering of a bunch. And then when, you know, I haven't played all over Europe, but the places I've played, it varies. It kind of depends. A lot of times, if there's a little bit of a language barrier, you know, the people I've worked with are lyrically oriented, meaning a lot of what you get out of their music is by understanding the words and the subtle
implications.
Thank you. Yes. So if you don't, if you're not a native speaker, you might miss a lot of that, and so you don't get a response there. So, but yeah, there's definitely a difference in audiences from region to region.
We're listening to Jason Wilber on Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and we are going to listen to a cut from John Prine's newest CD, Fair and Square. Jason is John Prine's lead guitar player. Is that right, Jason?
Right.
Is that your official title?
I'd say.
And the cut that you chose was I Hate It When That Happens to Me. Mm-hmm. Why'd you pick that one out?
I really had a lot of fun playing this one, and I got to play a little kind of a gut string part, a nylon string guitar part, and it reminded me of the kind of stuff I like to hear on some of the older country records and stuff. Guys like Grady Martin, as a guitar player, would play this kind of thing. And I was just really proud of the way it turned out, you know. So it was a lot of fun.
This is Jason Wilber playing lead guitar on John Prine's I Hate It When That Happens to Me.
Well, I once knew a man who was going insane. He that loved chase him right up a tree. It took the police and a fire truck just to bring him back down. Oh, I hate it when it happens to me. It made the front page of the paper. The gossip tongues wag. Why they even showed it all on TV. Now if he should live forever, he won't live it down. Oh, I hate it.
We've been listening to I Hate When That Happens to Me off of John Prine's Fair and Square, and that was Jason Wilber playing lead guitar. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is singer, songwriter, and recording artist, Jason Wilber. Jason, what do you see as the progression of your music, or do you think about that? How has your music changed over the last, I don't know, 20 years that you've been playing, and where do you see it going?
Well, initially I started playing other people's music for the most part and played in groups that were sort of recreating what had already been done. And I'd say in the last 10 or 12 years, the focus for me has definitely changed to, creating music that's a little more original, you know, either written by me or written by someone I'm working with. And so that's more, I find that to be more interesting than just trying to recreate something that someone else has done.
What do you think are the most important elements to keep on growing and expanding your creativity?
I'd say new information, I think, is the key. You know, hearing new recordings, old music that you've never heard before, new music that you haven't heard, favorite music that you haven't listened to in a while. That's what I find gives me the boost or a little spark that can inspire some new work. Also, I'd say learning about new things that are non-musical, you know, learning about a new hobby or reading a book about something I don't know anything about. I'd say those are all inspiring. So generally, new information, I think, inspires me, at least.
And do you always have music on at home? I mean, and when you're doing things, are you a constant listener or do you also like silence?
Kind of the opposite. I almost never listen to music unless I am specifically wanting to listen. It's really hard for me to, I think having spent so many years training myself to listen really carefully and be able to pick things apart and figure out what's going on and what I'm hearing, I now find it really hard to just have music playing. If I'm trying to work on something and music is playing, the music really sucks away my focus, you know. Mm-hmm. I find myself listening to, oh, here's what's happening. And so I don't, as a consequence, I don't listen to music very much at home. I listen to it in the car a lot. That's where I listen the most, I'd say, in the car.
When you go to learn a new piece that you're playing with someone else or to perfect a piece that you're working on yourself, mm-hmm. are you going off of written music? Are you operating often by just ear? Do you fool around a lot? Are you a rote learner? How do you master things?
Mostly, I guess mostly by listening and by imitation. I mean, there are certain things that I would write down if I didn't think I could remember them, or they're kind of complicated and I want to remember them exactly the way they should be. For the most part, the kind of music I play is usually comes from listening to someone play their song and maybe making some notes about it, or listening to a recording and making some notes, and then just playing along. It's kind of playing by ear in a way, because sort of memorize. I don't know. It's hard to describe, but it's kind of like if someone told you a few sentences you had to remember, you know, since you speak English and you know what the words are and you understand the thought, it's not difficult to remember. And I would say music is the same way.
Well, that's an interesting comparison. Yeah, it does.
Well, yeah, because, you know, I know the language. I know it means something to me, so it's not hard to remember something.
Actually, that makes a lot of sense, because I don't, being very non-musical myself, I don't mm-hmm. think music seems such a foreign language to
sure.
me that I wouldn't associate it with the same process.
Yeah.
But
it seems to me like it's a similar process. Of course, I only speak one language, so. But, yeah, I'd say it's just, you know how to make the sounds, and so when you hear the sounds, it's not hard to make that translation and connection.
And when you're working on something new, does that become your favorite thing at the moment? Like when you're into sort of a new phase of music and
mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say it often is. I think it requires, you probably have this experience as a writer, it requires some time and distance to really accurately assess, you know, how, for lack of better terminology, how good or bad the work is. Yeah, I often find that something I've just done is my favorite, you know.
The one that you're in love with right now.
Yeah.
Like Lazy Day.
Lazy Afternoon.
Or Lazy Afternoon, rather.
Yeah, that's probably one of my current favorites, I'd say.
Let me ask you, too, when you are working on writing a new song, mm-hmm. we talked about the fact that you know, you start off by trying to capture an emotion or an image or a feeling, and that you try to relate that to something that's involved in your own life so that you're able to write from your own experience.
Yes.
Do you set aside a certain amount of time each day to write, or are you working on it more inspirationally?
I'd say a little bit of both. I try to set aside some time every day for music. There have definitely been periods of time when I haven't done that, and I like to do it. I it's usually first thing in the morning for me after a little breakfast and read the paper. But, you know, you have to be ready whenever the idea comes to you. So I think if I have a good idea, I want to try to work on it right then, because I might not remember it later. So I'd say a little bit of both to answer your question.
And are you working on something currently, other new music right now? Or
I am working on some new music. Yeah, I haven't really decided exactly what... I wouldn't say I have a CD in the works or anything like that, but I'm definitely, you know, always writing. And
I know you get asked this a lot, but you sort of have, you're sort of cross-genre in a lot of way.
Mm-hmm.
And so how would you classify the kind of music that you play, and how would you classify it?
That's always a hard question, and I'm always feel like I should have a better answer. You know, I think of it as a blend of country, folk, and rock. I don't know how else to say it. There's probably other influences in there too. I don't know. That's always difficult though, to come up with a label.
Mm-hmm.
I think the singer-songwriter label is a good one though, because most of the music that I work on tends to be from singer-songwriters, and I think that's a unique kind of an animal, a little bit like a novelist, in that you're not only the creator of the work, the originator of the idea, but you're also the performer of it. So that, to me, is almost a genre in itself. I find those are the people I like to listen to. That's what I find interesting, and that's what I do myself.
Mm-hmm.
So,
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is singer-songwriter Jason Wilbur. Jason, when you're playing music, are there particular folks that you think have really influenced you other than the people that you've played with, like Iris DeMann or John Prine or Carrie Newcomer? Are there, I know I'm leaving Hal Ketchum, I know I'm leaving out a lot of folks, but are there other artists that you think have been big influences for you?
Oh, sure, definitely, yeah. And I'm sure I'll forget half of them when I'm trying to say who they are, but Tom T. Hall was a big influence on me originally. He's a country, kind of a country
western. Thank you. You saw the look on my face and said, who was that?
And I always loved his songs because they're so much, they sound like little vignettes from his everyday life. I'm sure that's what they are for the most part. And a lot of them don't even have a chorus or anything. It's just sort of a story set to music, you know. And so I always loved his music. And but there are so many, gosh, I mean, anybody who's ever written, if somebody has one good song, that could be an influence, you know. I like people like Townes Van Zandt or, of course, you know, the people that everybody knows like Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen. There are just tons of people. Ron Sexsmith. There's a great Canadian singer-songwriter named Ron Hines, who I only discovered a year or two ago, and he's fantastic. He's one of my favorites now, I'd say. And so there's a staggering amount of great music out there to be inspired by.
Do you have a favorite story from one of your tours with John Prine? Something surprising that happened to you or just something that you think about when you think about being on tour?
I do. I don't know if I can do the story justice. You know, after you've heard John Prine tell a story about something, it's really hard to it makes me realize that I really can't tell stories very well.
Well, give it a try.
Yeah, I'll
Jason.
Give it a try. I'd say the most notable thing was what we refer to as the Giant Orange story, which was David Jakes, who plays bass with John, and John Prine and I were driving through Wisconsin on a tour one time, and it was just the three of us in a rental car, and we were driving. I think we had to be at a sound check somewhere like in Green Bay or Appleton or somewhere, Wisconsin at 5 o'clock. And we were driving in the afternoon. And as we were driving, John was telling us about how he used to be stationed on an army base in this area. And that there was this place where he used to go sometimes. And they made giant statues for restaurants. They made like big chicken for a fried chicken place or, you know, those kind of big giant fiberglass statues that stand out in front of restaurants. And so we were driving through the countryside, and he told us the story. And then all of a sudden we're driving down this little road, and we go past this place. And there's all these statues out in the field, you know, and things laying on their side. And there was one that looked like Gulliver laying on his back. And there were it was very odd. And we were kind of running late for our sound check, and we still had a ways to go. But after we had gone down the road maybe another mile, John said, you know, we've got to turn around and go back because when are we ever going to pass this again? So we drove back and we got out of the car, and it was a Sunday afternoon, I think, and there didn't really seem to be anyone around. There was a couple of big kind of garage warehouse type buildings, but they were all closed up. And so in these kind of overgrown fields all around this place, it was like a graveyard of all these sort of old statues and things, the big chicken, and like I said, the guy that looked like Gulliver. And then there were all kinds of things that were like obviously the molds for all these different big statues. So they were like the reverse of all the statues, and they were laying around everywhere. And it was really strange, and it was kind of cold. I seem to remember it being maybe November or December. So we were walking around outside, and I walked past, there was a little group of giant oranges, maybe 8 or 10 feet tall, you know.
Made of plastic?
Made of fiberglass, I guess is what they're made of. I'm not sure about that exactly. But so we're kind of walking a little spread out, and we walked past this orange, and I heard a very muffled voice saying something like, you know, rawr, rawr, rawr. And we all kind of stopped and looked at each other. And the way John told it later, which I think was very accurate, he said, no one wanted to be the first one to say, did you hear something, you know? So everybody kind of stopped, and then we heard it again, you know. We heard this this noise again, and it seemed to be coming from this giant orange that I happened to be standing closest to. So I kind of said, you know, hello, yes, and which was kind of ridiculous, but and so I could kind of hear there was a little voice in there, and it sounded like a young girl, and she said, "Hey, we're trapped in here, inside the giant orange. Would you let us out?" And of course, I'm thinking, we're on candid camera or something, you know. And I said, "Are you really trapped in this? Are you kidding me? You know, are you putting us on?" And she said, "No, we're trapped in the orange. You know, you got to get us out of here." And I said, "Well, what do we do?" You know, she said, "There's a little door, you know, on the side." And so I looked, and there was a little door, and so I kind of kicked it, and it sort of swung open. And I'm not kidding you, two girls, maybe 12 or 13 years old, on roller skates, climb out of the giant orange, and they're crying. And they said, "Oh, thanks, we were trapped in there for 3 hours, you know, we were freezing." And then they just kind of walked off on their roller skates across this field.
And that was it?
And that was it, and we were all just... We just kind of all looked, you know, I didn't even know what to say. We just sort of all got in the car and took off. And then oddly enough, as a postscript or whatever, we 2 or 3 years later, we're driving through the same part of Wisconsin again. And we drove past the same place and we thought, well, we got to stop again, you know. And again, it was a weekend, I think maybe a Saturday, and there was really no one around. And so we walked around. We said, "Oh, there's the giant orange," you know, and unfortunately, no one was trapped in it this time, but we did see one of the buildings. Someone was in there working on one of these statues, painting it or something, and we kind of went in and we're sort of watching from the door, and the woman turned around and said, "Oh, hi, how you doing?" And we said, "Oh, we're just walking around." And we got to talking, and one of us mentioned that we had been by a few years ago and actually saved some people that were trapped in orange, and her face kind of lit up. She said, "You're the guys?" And evidently it had been in the local paper the next day. And so it was kind of entertaining. Yeah.
And have you or John Prine written a song about this?
No. I don't know if you could write a song about that. It's maybe better just as a story, you know.
Not the tour story one would expect, Jason. It took me by surprise. I know you do have another song to play for us, though. What song were you going to play?
I'm going to play one off of my King for a Day CD called In Her Veins.
Oh, would you call that a ballad? Is that a fair name?
Yeah,
for it?
I think that qualifies as a ballad. Yeah.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU, and we're going to listen to Jason Wilbur play one of his own songs, In Her Veins.
Flowers don't grow unless she says they can. The sun won't rise until she waves a hand. Electricity is in her veins, and it pulls at me like that. And when
we've been listening to Jason Wilbur play In Her Veins off of his CD, King for a Day. Jason, you want to talk a little bit about writing that song? Where'd it come from?
Sure. I can't remember exactly how it started or, you know, what part of it came first, but generally at the time it seemed to be kind of a love song, sort of one of those relationships where you feel like maybe you want to get out of it, but you really can't, you know, you're drawn back into it. And after I wrote the song and played it for a couple of years, it really started to occur to me that it was more about being a performer, being an artist, you know, of sometimes feeling like, you know, I hate to sound overly dramatic, but sometimes it feels like more of a burden than a privilege, you know, and that sounds really...
Explain yourself
silly.
A little bit, because I think I do understand what you mean. And I've certainly read a lot of writers and artists talking about this need to get something out instead of just be.
Yeah, I guess I just by that I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say. You know, you're creating something that's so much a part of you. It's so personal, and yet you kind of have to stick it out there in the world, and then kind of subject it to other people's opinions. You know.
I guess you haven't been to too many writing workshops.
Right. Exactly. No, but I think. I'm getting a little off track here, but what I was trying to say was I think that's maybe what the song is about more than a romantic relationship. It's more like the relationship of being an artist, of feeling compelled to express yourself in this way, even if sometimes it seems kind of like more trouble than it's worth, for lack of a better mm-hmm. Terminology. And after I kind of made that realization about this song, that it was maybe a little more about being an artist than about being in a romantic relationship, it occurred to me that a lot of songs and stories are written about a romantic relationship because that's something that's very accessible and it's easy for all of us to get into and understand on different levels. But it's great metaphorically because it can express the nature of so many other kinds of relationships and conditions. Mm-hmm. So, and actually, it was rewarding to me. I played that song once at somewhere, and a woman came up to me after the show, and she said, "I'm a professional cellist, you know." And that song's about being a musician, isn't it? And I said, "Well, yeah, I think it kind of is." That's great. That was nice. It's kind of rewarding to have someone else
recognize
that, yeah, in the song. So it wasn't just my imagination.
Jason, do you think that people can get a good idea of who you are by listening to your music, or are they missing a big piece of who you are?
I think you can get an idea if a person's music is honest. I think you can get an idea of some of who they are. I don't think you can get the complete idea of who they are. And I would say that applies to me too.
And is your music honest?
I try very hard to make it honest, yeah.
And when you talk about your music being honest, I know mm-hmm. that you talked about drawing from your own experiences
right.
and being real. What other kinds of characteristics would you give to honest music?
Well, I think some of it is what feels right to me or to you, however you want to say it. You know, making decisions when you're, you know, creating something, whether you're writing the song or recording the song or performing the song, is all about a series of questions and decisions. You know, do you do it this way or this way? Do I do this or this? When I get here, should it be this or this? You know, it's always about making choices and decisions. And your personal taste, as it influences those decisions, is what makes your work unique. So I try to make the decisions based on my honest feeling and not based on what I think someone else will like. So I would say that's what I mean by honest.
Great. If you had to name three favorite songs, not your own,
okay,
what would they be?
Wow, this is a tough one. This is a tough
just for
one.
The moment. It
just
doesn't have to be
moment.
Lifelong favorite.
Okay. Well, I'd say John Prine's song "Souvenirs" is one of my favorites, just because I think it's such a great expression of the happy and sad parts of our lives. Gosh, I really like Bob Dylan's song "Tangled Up in Blue."
Oh.
That's such a masterpiece of story and words and music. So that's a great one. You know, I really like the Pink Floyd song "Us and Them." It's very sparse lyrically, but to me, it creates such a mood, and it's such a it's such a universal kind of a thought that's being expressed. The thought of us and them, you know, that's kind of the source of all the problems in the world, I think, is the notion that there is an us and them. It's an interesting topic, you know.
Yeah. Jason's going to play one more song with us from Behind the Midway, and that is "Lay Down When You're Done." Here's Jason Wilbur playing and singing "Lay Down When You're Done."
Thank you.
crooked people, empty stairs, the windows rattle, and the daylight scares. The breeze blows the doors to days long since passed away. Raise the sky up high on your shoulders, let the days go and come. Yesterday can be what it was, just lay down when you're done.
Thanks, Jason. You've been listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Jason Wilbur, singer-songwriter. Jason performs and tours widely with John Prine and also has three solo CDs, Lost in My Hometown, Behind the Midway, and King for a Day. Jason, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Shauna.
You're welcome.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in August of 2005. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blacklin, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.